After Southern troops routed the Northerners at Bull Run Creek in July 1861, President Lincoln appointed a new general to whip the army into shape. George McClellan was a stocky little man with a moustache, only 34, but he'd catapulted to fame with victories in Western Virginia, winning the nickname the Young Napoleon. McClellan rooted out the dud officers and drilled the troops, to whom he became a hero. But he got carried away by the adulation of politicians and soldiers, as letters to his wife clearly show.
I find myself in a strange position here, President, Cabinet, and all deferring to me. I have conversation after conversation calling on me to save the nation. God has placed a great work in my hands.
Being talked up as a superman may be nice for the ego, but eventually you have to deliver, and that McClellan couldn't do. He was a great trainer of men, but he shrank from battle. Instead, he kept asking for more troops, more supplies, and more time.
I can't tell you how disgusted I am becoming with these wretched politicians. They are a most despicable set of men. The president is nothing more than a well-meaning baboon. It begins to look as if we are condemned to a winter of inactivity. If it is so, the fault will not be mine.
As the spring of 1862 approached, Lincoln was impatient for action. He told his advisers,
"If General McClellan does not want to use the army, I would like to borrow it for a time, provided I could see how it could be made to do something."
But McClellan kept insisting there was a massive Confederate army waiting for him in Northern Virginia. Eventually ordered into action by the president, he decided to move his army by boat and approach the Confederate capital of Richmond from the east. Alerted by spies in Washington, the Southern troops retreated south, revealing to McClellan's embarrassment that some of their imposing gun emplacements were nothing more than painted logs. Once established on the York Peninsula, McClellan inched his way toward Richmond, earning the derisive nickname the Virginia Creeper. He was one of those generals who, in the last analysis, wouldn't gamble, wouldn't go for the jugular. But more charitably, one could say that he drew back from the butchery of total war. He told Lincoln that the conflict
should be conducted upon the highest principles known to Christian civilization.
But Lincoln, now growing into the job, could see that war was a brutal business. And other generals had no compunction about taking the gloves off. Ulysses S. Grant had been a failure most of his life. After serving in the Mexican War of the 1840s, he left the U.S. Army, kicked out for boozing, said his detractors, driven to drink by depression, according to more sympathetic biographers. Grant then tried a succession of jobs, ending up in his late 30s selling saddles and other leather goods in his father's store in Illinois. People spoke of the vacant expression on his face as he came to work every day. Grant might have spent the rest of his days comatose in Galena, Illinois, but 1861 brought him to life. He understood that war was very simple. It was about killing. And Grant, though in normal life a gentleman, would prove utterly ruthless on the battlefield. Re-enlisting, Grant catapulted to national fame in February 1862 when leading the siege of Fort Donelson in Tennessee. The Confederate commander, General Buckner, had been a buddy of Grant's at West Point Military Academy and in the Mexican War. He expected that membership of the same club would ensure gentlemanly terms. Grant's reply was terse, courteous, and brutal.
"Sir, yours of this date, proposing armistice and appointment of commissioners to settle terms of a capitulation, is just received. No terms, except an unconditional and immediate surrender, can be accepted. I am, sir, very respectfully, your obedient servant, U.S. Grant."
Buckner protested at Grant's ungenerous and unchivalrous terms, but he had no choice. Northerners, starved for victories, were jubilant. Newspapers claimed that Grant's initials stood for unconditional surrender, and reports of the general calmly puffing away under fire brought him cigars from all over the country. Free smokes for the rest of his life proved, however, a mixed blessing. Grant was later to die, very painfully, from cancer of the throat. Fort Donelson was an easy victory. Grant's mettle was proved 2 months later, in April 1862, at a little wooden Methodist church called Shiloh, Hebrew for place of peace. A byproduct of Grant's aggressive spirit was spasms of overconfidence. That Sunday morning, the Confederates surprised his troops finishing breakfast and drove them back in disarray. The Union soldiers rallied, and there was bitter fighting in a peach orchard, with pink blossom raining down in the hail of bullets. Sam Watkins of Tennessee was one of the follow-up Southern troops.
I never realized the pomp and circumstance of the thing called Glorious War until I saw this. Men were lying in every conceivable position. The dead lying with their eyes wide open, the wounded begging piteously for help. It all seemed to me a dream. I seemed to be in a sort of haze. But when the order to charge was given, I got happy. I felt happier than a fella does when he professes religion at a big Methodist camp meeting. I shouted. It was fun then. Everybody looked happy. One more charge, then their lines waver and break. They retreat in wild confusion. We were jubilant. We were triumphant.
For the North, that day at Shiloh was a disaster. But crucially, Grant kept his nerve. One of his officers, William Tecumseh Sherman, found him that night sheltering from the rain under a tree.
Well, Grant, we've had the devil's own day, haven't we?
Grant nodded.
Yes, lick 'em tomorrow.
Grant was right. During the night, thousands of reinforcements arrived, many of them by boat at a landing on the nearby Tennessee River. In the morning, they ploughed victoriously into the weary Confederates, driving them from the field. But the carnage was immense. More Americans died at Shiloh than in all the country's previous wars combined. Sam Watkins was among the survivors, and his luck held. He would be one of only seven in his entire company of 120 to live through the whole conflict. Such killing was a new way of war. But when Watkins first saw Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general...
He looked like some good boy's grandpa. I felt like going up to him and saying, "Good evening, Uncle Bob." His whole makeup of form and person, looks and manner had a kind of gentle and soothing magnetism about it that it drew everyone to him and made them love, respect, and honor him. I fell in love with the old gentleman and felt like going home with him.
Bobby Lee was a different man in the heat of battle. Then, like Grant, he became a killer. Lee believed, like Napoleon, that audacity and aggression were the most important attributes of a general. His cavalry literally ran rings around McClellan. He divided his forces and launched them in surprise attacks, and he kept engaging the enemy as McClellan pulled back down the peninsula. The campaign was named aptly as the Seven Days Battles. Southern losses were double those of the North, but Lee won the campaign because McClellan's unnerved army was evacuated back to Washington. The dreadful losses were due most of all to rifles. Using a rifled barrel and a cone-shaped bullet instead of a smoothbore musket and round ball was a military revolution. Spinning a rifled bullet through the air increased its range fourfold and enhanced its accuracy to lethal effect. Tactically, this gave defenders a massive advantage. Yet West Point tactics still gave pride of place to the offensive, and Lee proved himself a master of that game. He, not McClellan, was the true Napoleon of the 1860s. But warfare was moving on from the Napoleonic era, as Lee would eventually learn the hard way. By 1862, more than a year into the war, things looked promising for the South. It couldn't hope to defeat the North, which had double the population and most of America's industry, but all it needed to do was avoid defeat until Northerners lost the will to fight. Whereas the North had to win, which meant invading and conquering the South. And that it seemed unable to do. A critical factor was the attitude of Britain, whose textile industry relied on cotton from the South. British opinion wasn't pro-slavery, but that didn't seem to be the issue, because Lincoln said the fight was to preserve the Union, not to free the slaves. In which case, many in Britain felt that the United States had become an overmighty empire, and that the South was simply fighting for independence. The Times declared,
"We are but uttering the thoughts of 9 Englishmen out of 10 when we say that should it appear that the army of McClellan has been so totally defeated as to be incapable of resuming offensive operations, then the propriety of treating the Confederates as an independent people may be justly discussed by the British Cabinet."
Lee decided to give history a nudge. He hoped that an invasion of the North would prompt European mediation, and that in turn would put political pressure on Lincoln, because, said Lee, a proposal of peace
would enable the people of the United States to determine at their coming elections whether they will support those who favor a prolongation of the war or those who wish to bring it to a termination.
But Lee overreached himself when he marched into Maryland. The Union army wasn't as demoralized as he believed, and McClellan was able to bring huge superiority of numbers to bear. This time even he knew it, thanks to a careless Confederate officer who'd left a copy of Lee's orders wrapped around some cigars dropped in a field. Over 2 days in September 1862, Lee and McClellan slugged it out around the little town of Sharpsburg, Maryland, in rolling farmland, along a sunken road, and across Antietam Creek. Total casualties were 4 times those inflicted on the U.S. Army in Normandy on the morning of D-Day. Lee suffered less, but his small, shattered army had no choice but to turn back to Virginia. A general with more nerve and drive than McClellan would have finished off Lee's retreating army, and Lincoln was furious. A couple of months later, he sacked McClellan for good. But the failure of the South's invasion had a decisive effect in Europe. British opinion turned against the idea of recognising the Confederacy. The Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston, noted,
"I am very much come back to our original view of the matter, that we must continue to be lookers-on till the war shall have taken a more decided turn."
And a Southern defeat gave Lincoln the political leeway to issue a statement prepared months before but kept in his desk drawer for the right moment. 5 days after the Battle of Antietam, he finally spoke out. What he said would transform the whole meaning of the war.